This is the Takeaway Podcast. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. This is turning out to be an amazing week. I mean, every day there is some tantalizing new detail about Iran's approach to the world. The axis of evil has become a nexus of opportunity, it seems like, in U.S.-Iran relations, in influencing the war in Syria. We're going to talk about that in a moment. The new president of Iran wrote an editorial for the Washington Post today. You have to read it. It was a well-researched call for constructive dialogue on what it is that the international community wants to achieve in the Middle East. That's what he calls for. My entire career in journalism has been framed by the revolution that overthrew the Shah of Iran in 1979. A hostage crisis that created the narrative of terrorism that has defined so much of Middle East history, the narrative that gave us a new meaning of martyrdom, introduced us to a modern new meaning of jihad. We'll talk about all of that this hour. But in reading the editorial from Iran's new president, Hassan Rouhani, I may not be able to get used to, at least right away, not being called the eternal enemy or the great Satan and the like. That language is just so embedded in my notions of U.S.-Iranian relations. And language like axis of evil on the U.S. side may need to go away in this period as well. This hour, could Iran, jihad, the violence in Syria find a redefinition in new talks between Iran's leader and the U.S. president? Nothing official yet, but a lot of tantalizing signs. Also, potentially revolutionary comments from the Pope suggesting that the church neglects its moral vision by focusing on narrow rules regarding piety and battles over abortion and homosexuality. We'll talk about that. But we begin with Iran. Just days before the United Nations General Assembly is set to convene here in New York City, President Hassan Rouhani has been showing the world a softer side. In that op-ed piece written by President Rouhani in today's Washington Post, the Iranian leader called on world leaders to seize the opportunity presented by Iran's recent election and to engage with him in constructive dialogue. And when President Rouhani addresses the United Nations General Assembly next week, he's expected to present an Iran ready to engage with the West. Meanwhile, President Obama has sent the Iranian leadership a private letter, 1.5 pages in length, calling on Iran to come to an agreement over its nuclear program. And President Obama has offered to conduct face-to-face talks. Nothing scheduled yet. Gary Sick, senior research scholar at Columbia University's Middle East Institute and an adjunct professor at the School of International and Public Affairs, has lived this history. He's the author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran. Gary Sick, welcome back to the program.
It's very good to be here.
This does seem like something real is happening here. Balance your skepticism with your intense interest in what's going on.
Well, this is truly new. And it isn't that all these positions are new or that Iran's capabilities for negotiation are new. It's that it's being packaged and presented to, I think, the American people for the very first time in at least 10 years. President Khatami, in earlier days, did very much the same thing, came to the United States. In that time, it took us 2 years before we were prepared to say, oh, maybe there's something going on here that we ought to pay attention to. By that time, he was actually wounded and could not perform on his end. So I think there's a lesson here, which is we have a limited amount of time. We have domestic policies on both sides, Iran and the United States, which, as you suggested, actually drive us apart. And we're so accustomed to thinking of each other as the enemy that thinking about it in anything like a more constructive way is really very difficult. And I think we're at a point now where if both sides can show a little imagination and can, in fact, begin dealing with each other in a somewhat different way, we have the possibility of something good happening. If we don't, if we delay and delay and delay and can't make up our minds whether we want to take this chance or not, the moment is going to pass very quickly for both of us, because there are people in this country that very much want to, say, pass a resolution calling for more military attacks against Iran. There are people in Iran that are just waiting to jump on Rouhani, the new president, and say, you failed to get anything back, and see that all your being nice doesn't get you anywhere. Only the Americans only understand pressure. So there are people on both sides that are making the same argument. At the moment, they're relatively quiet, but they're not going to stay that way.
Is what's driving this simply a matter of time passing and some of the bitterness really losing its edge? Is it President Obama seeing a legacy question here and Rouhani also seeing that? Or is there some sort of imperative, maybe regarding Syria, that's pushing this?
No, I think Syria actually is turning out to be a point of opportunity, but that actually we can, in fact, engage Iran seriously about Syria because in many respects they're on our side. They also want to see Syria do away with its chemical weapons, as Iran has done. And I think that embarrassed them greatly that their ally was using chemical weapons, so they don't say it specifically. And Iran can also play a constructive role if we bring them into the conversation, which we're talking about Geneva II, a meeting in Geneva to think about the future of Syria. Iran should be at that table, and that they would appreciate the opportunity to be at that table, and that would put them on notice that they have to behave in a constructive way. So there, actually, Syria does provide an interesting opportunity. But to answer your question, I do not think that this is an indication that some of the old pain and anger have worn off. Quite the contrary, I think Iran realized that Ahmadinejad, the previous president, had done more damage to his country than almost any enemy could possibly have done. He made Iran a hated name everywhere. He turned it into a pariah state. He almost single-handedly destroyed their economy. And I think what we're seeing from Rouhani is a determination. He's going to be the anti-Ahmadinejad. He is going to be the fellow who comes along and tries to dig them out of this hole that they've put themselves in. And I think he realizes that it's now or never. And I do think that Rouhani sees this as a make-or-break moment. And I think if he is wise, that President Obama will look at it the same way. Mm-hmm. Here is an opportunity to do something that is really major, because the Iran relationship actually poisons our relations all across the Middle East. Every problem has Iran tied up in it. If we can make some progress, right, we don't have to love each other and we don't have to become best buddies, but if we do make some progress with each other, there's a chance that the temperature of all of those issues will decline slightly. Mm. And that would be a huge achievement.
Well, Rouhani is the anti-Ahmadinejad at this point just by these overtures. And the question is, will a new tone and a whole new sort of focus on U.S.-Iran relations develop? Gary Sick, thanks so much.
It was a pleasure talking to you.
Gary Sick is a senior research scholar at Columbia University's Middle East Institute, the author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran. This is The Takeaway. So what about Syria? Is there an opportunity here? Should a significant change take place in the relationship between the U.S. and Iran? Bill Keller joins us, former executive editor of our partner, The New York Times. Bill, I suggest you say yes.
I do say yes, although I would qualify that a little bit. I think the main focus should be the nuclear program. We face two really bad potential outcomes, or have been living with two really bad potential outcomes. One of them is Iran with a nuclear weapon, and the other one is a preemptive attack by Israel and or the United States. And so we should be making every effort to promote a third option, which is a deal. So I'm not suggesting that we should take our eye off that ball. But the point I would make is that, you know, Iran is not just a rogue nuclear program. It is a major player in the region. It's possible. You obviously want to approach this with skepticism. You want to test and verify. But it's possible we can do business with them on several fronts: anti-terror, Afghanistan, Iraq, and most urgently, Syria. If we want to get beyond – I mean, I wish every success in this effort to get rid of Assad's chemical arsenal. I think that would be a blessing for mankind. But if we want to go beyond that and actually stop the slaughter of now over 100,000 Syrians and the refugee burden that this is placing on a bunch of neighbors who happen to be good allies of ours, then that requires more than just Russia and the U.S. And the United Nations. It requires Saudi Arabia. It requires Turkey. And above all, it requires Iran, because Iran is arguably more important in Syria than Russia and has more at stake.
Absolutely. Well, let's go over some of the language in Rouhani's op-ed piece in the Washington Post. And Gary Sick raised this point a moment ago by suggesting that the chemical weapons episode in Syria whatever else it did, it seems to have raised a sense of the tenuous WMD balance that exists between Israel and Syria and some of those nations, and Iran particularly. And Iran does not want to go down that road. I'm wondering if that explains this language. Listen, Rouhani says that it's a peaceful nuclear program that's all about diversifying their energy options. Now, they've said things like that before, but that particular wording, do you buy it? Is that something to be skeptical about?
It's something to be skeptical about. They have said many times in the past that they have – that they disavow – there are even fatwas ruling that nuclear weapons are sinful. And yet they go ahead and enrich to levels way beyond what they need for their civilian program. And they dissemble and they hide stuff and they bury it deep in the ground. So, of course, you want to be skeptical and you want to make sure that whatever deal they come up with includes very intense inspection regimes and total transparency. But that said, I do think this is, as Gary said, that this is a moment. And one of the reasons, by the way, that he didn't mention – I agree with just about everything he said. But one thing that he omitted is, since we've spent a lot of time lately pointing out the stumbles in President Obama's conduct of foreign policy, one very large reason that President Rouhani is making this charm offensive is that the sanctions have hurt Iran desperately. And those sanctions were constructed by President Obama. He had the credibility to really muster international opprobrium against Iran's nuclear program because he started out by offering an olive branch, which Ahmadinejad rejected.
And maybe there's a challenge built in there as well by Rouhani against Russia, saying a zero-sum Cold War mentality causes everyone to lose. It will be interesting to see if Iran is at a table talking about Syria sometime between now and the end of the year. Bill Keller, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Bill Keller, former executive editor of our partner, The New York Times. Later this hour, we're talking about the stereotypes that are associated with some names and asking you how you got your name.
Hi, this is Tim from Mineola, New York. I was born right before Christmas in 1947, and I was only 4 pounds, tiny, so they called me Tiny Tim. Thank you.
Can you play the ukulele, though? That's really the question. And on Facebook, Leslie writes, my mother thought I was going to be a boy, so my name was supposed to be Wesley Jr. I came out a girl, and after 6 days, she got as close as she could with Leslie. Rhymes with Wesley. I get it. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Coming up, reaction to Pope Francis's surprise announcement backing the Catholic Church away from issues of abortion and homosexuality. Where is the vision in the church? Asks the Pope. Stay with us. This weekend, imams and religious leaders in Pakistan have been asked to preach a sermon on the treatment of girls. They've declared it, "My daughter is a blessing, not a curse day," to fight violence against women. Also, some surprising talk about women from the Vatican this week. In his first extended interview, the Pope argues that the church has grown obsessed with condemning abortion, gay marriage, and contraception. Women should be welcomed into the church, not judged with political tests on sexuality, says the Pope. Where is the church's invitation for all? Reacting to this for us is Dr. Victoria Fleming, a therapist and practicing Catholic, and Reverend James Bretsky, a professor of moral theology at Boston College School of Theology. Welcome to you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. It's good to be here.
So, Victoria, your reaction? I mean, the idea that the Catholic Church is obsessed with rules certainly doesn't come as a surprise to anybody, maybe than a pope.
Right. I'm just so happy with what he said, because it does seem like he is positioning the church to really put the ministry of the church back up in front in terms of the list of priorities. So I'm just thrilled with what he came out with yesterday.
Churches have always struggled, and down through the centuries, struggled with this question of how to enforce piety versus how to project a moral vision. Reverend Bretsky, is that what's going on here?
Well, I think that that's what's coming down here. I think also the Pope himself is trying to get back to the core gospel message, which is to go out and to seek out sinners and the wounded and bring them back. And that is a new emphasis.
And it really will have an impact on an enormous number of very divisive debates within the Catholic Church. What do you see it affecting most quickly, James Bretzky?
Well, I think it's going to affect the smaller number of American bishops who are trying to say to be a good Catholic, you have to follow a certain political agenda. I think there's going to be great disappointment because a number of bishops have tried to make the case you can never negotiate on certain matters and that the abortion, gay marriage, stem cell research, contraception, healthcare mandate thing is the core Catholic message. And I think the Pope is saying it is not.
Now, the Pope would seem to say that those battles, while not unimportant, it sounds like he's saying they don't have a lot of relevance to people. And he's trying to speak past the Catholic hierarchy to people like you, Dr. Fleming. Is he right about that, that those battles over abortion and stem cells are kind of irrelevant to you and that you're much more interested in some of these other more strictly moral questions?
Well, I don't think his text read that he was casting them out off as irrelevant. I think he was just saying, the message that I took, was that they have distracted from the main ministry of Christ, which was to be of service to one another, to love one another, and to inspire people to be in a relationship with God. And the church, through its agenda, has been sadly interfering with that rather than facilitating that. So that's what I took out of his message.
So the message is more, whether he said relevant or not, is more meaningful and relevant to the way you practice Catholicism, right, Dr. Fleming?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is such welcome news. And I do think that this is very consistent with the agenda of the nuns on the bus. I think that this is very consistent with the agenda of many progressive Catholics and people, frankly, who have left the church. I can't wait to see what sort of the longer term implications this will have in terms of the church numbers and people coming back to the church, thinking that the church is going to be more aligned with the gospel.
Will this, Reverend Bretzky, bring people back to the church, or will it simply empower people who behave in ways that lots of people who describe themselves as lapsed Catholics behave and simply allow them to say, see, we're fine, leave us alone?
Well, I think it will bring people back to the church. It's probably too early to tell, but looking at my Facebook comments today, I would say a number of people that I know that are not practicing Catholics have commented on this in a very positive fashion. So I think it will bring people back, and more importantly, or at least as importantly, it's going to energize and give great hope to the people who have never left, but who have been distressed perhaps by some of these emphases in the last pontificate or two.
And you see that individuals who may have commented on Facebook suddenly may have a path back to a church that is suddenly welcoming?
Yes, I think because the Pope is saying explicitly, we want you back and we want to go out to you. The previous popes never said, we don't want you back, but they didn't say, we want to go out to you. So I think that is a new stress.
You know, it's fascinating to me also this Sunday, I mean, it has nothing to do with the Pope, but there is an edict, a message from Muslim clerics in Pakistan to preach that women are valued and that daughters are to be viewed as miracles, not curses. And that's something that relates to problems between the genders going on in the Muslim community. This is an interesting time for messages from the pulpit, wouldn't you say?
I believe so. One of the most interesting things he said in the interview was he said, what's a dead end? It would be to make a female machismo. Of course, machismo is a concept he's well familiar with. And I think that's true. You can't have the place of women in the church just to identically clone men, but to try to bring the particular gifts that every person has, and in this case, the gifts that women have as women, into the church. And he says, that's what we've got to work on.
And that's a message you're hearing, Dr. Fleming?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I do believe that this is as much of a call for change as we're going to hear from that level. And I really think that that's what this was. It was he really did emphasize what a loss it would be not to have the voices of women and all of the gifts that women have to offer more present in the church. There is a real traditional thread among the Catholic community that the role of women in the church is to either be sisters or to be working in the church offices. And I think the notion that the women will have an increasing role in the decision-making process, really a seat at the table where those conversations are even having place, that's a really exciting possibility.
Dr. Victoria Fleming is a therapist and practicing Catholic. She's the author of the book You Complete Me and Other Myths That Destroy Happily Ever After. And Reverend James Bretzky is a professor of moral theology at Boston College School of Theology and Ministry. Reverend and Doctor, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you, John.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Smooth sound of precision mechanics, the rhythmic clicking of finely tuned bicycles, chains flipping from gear to gear, the occasional handlebar bell, and then let's add some, like harp, a drum kit, some sticks on metal tubing, and the symphony is born. Now, bring in the chorus.
Climbing up higher, strenuously pedaling, king of the mountain.
Wheels spinning round, pedaling to work or play. All paths are joyful.
You're listening to The Takeaway's Nationwide Bike Challenge. Some of your haikus there about your bike or your bike riding experience. To enter our contest, visit our website at thetakeaway.org. Three judges will vote and select their top 10 haikus, and winners will get Takeaway bike helmets courtesy of Bicycle Habitat in New York City. Submissions are being accepted until 11:59 p.m. Eastern on Sunday, September 22nd. That's this Sunday. We brought two guys into our studios in Chicago last week to help us with our soundtrack for all this. Bicycles recycled as instruments, racking up decibels, not road miles. Charlie Malavay and Ezra Lang, two members of the Chicago-based band Schwintone Nation. When they race, everybody wins.
I mean, when I look at an old bicycle, it's like, that's an instrument. That's not a bike anymore. It's passed on to the next stage of its evolution, and so we turn them into these weird, junky-looking things that people then ask us when they see them, oh, well, can you fix my bike? It's like, no, I can't fix your bike, but I can turn it into a functioning musical instrument.
And because you are musicians, you actually don't call your instruments weird, junky-looking things. You have names for them. Could we go through the list of instruments that you have there in the studio and hear a little bit of each one?
Okay. Little Poppy is a pitched percussion instrument that is essentially an old 10-speed frame that's been sawed. The top tube and the down tube have been sawed off at various lengths to create different pitches. And then we take old inner tube, stretch that over the open end of the metal tubing, and then it creates a little drum head, and we get this little pitched percussion effect.
And that's not wood. That's rubber.
Yeah, that's rubber stretched over hollow metal tubing.
Nice.
Mounted to a wheel in a nice circular fashion for ease of playing. You know, some of our inspiration comes from gamelan, so we look at instrument construction that, you know, of resonating things or, you know, small pitched percussion that give us ideas.
Yeah. Everybody says they got to be inspired by gamelan. That's so hip to
it's
say.
It's the hot thing right
now.
Yeah,
totally. All right, what about wind instruments? You got any?
We do. Here, let me drag one of these out. This is just some ram's horn handlebars. And basically, it's an open end of metal tubing that's bent in a strange way. And we can either play it like a flute or kind of a drony trumpet kind
Horn-ish.
Of thing, horn.
Wow.
I'm about to move over to the bicycle for you.
Okay, here we go.
So the bicycle is a two-string upright bass made, again, almost entirely out of bicycle parts. There it is. And so it's not an acoustic instrument naturally, so we have a contact microphone on it. And that allows us to hear the vibrations through the instrument. And it's actually got a pretty decent upright bass sound on it.
Hmm. That sounds beautiful. Let's hear some music from the Schwintone Nation, or at least two members of the Schwintone Nation Ensemble. Charlie Malavay and Ezra Lang are members of Schwinn Tone Nation, and we want to hear your poetry when it comes to bikes.
Climbing up higher, strenuously pedaling, king of the mountain.
Submit your haiku between now and Sunday by visiting us at thetakeaway.org.
Dad, are any of these movies good?
Worst episode ever.
I see a lot of films. I love all of them.
Your job is to rate movies on a scale from good to excellent.
Hated it.
Movie time. Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway, co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, also co-host of the podcast. Welcome, guys.
Hi, John.
Hi, John.
You know, I'm excited. There's some pretty interesting movies this weekend. Prisoners, Hugh Jackman, Jake Gyllenhaal getting great reviews. Ron Howard has another car movie out. He's done some car movies in the past. We might get a chance to talk about that. And there's another documentary, because I guess in public radio, we always have to talk about documentaries.
That's right.
That's right, yeah. Well, let's start with the first movie, Prisoners, here. Let's hear a clip.
Mr. Dover, I understand this is an incredibly hard time, but I have every uniformed police officer in this state looking for Anna.
I don't understand what any of this means. They said he ran. They said he tried to get away. I don't understand why he would try to run away.
I hear what you're saying. I'm not crossing anybody off my list. Just let me do my job.
Very tense movie, very exciting trailer. What do you think, Kristen?
So that is Jake Gyllenhaal, who's the investigator in a kidnapping case. Hugh Jackman, his daughter was kidnapped while playing with her best friend. Her best friend's father is Terrence Howard. And these two fathers are dealing with their daughters being kidnapped, how to track them down. And the idea of what it feels like to be a prisoner is explored on many levels in this movie. I thought it was fantastic. It's over 2.5 hours long. A lot of people aren't going to be able to sit through all of that, but it held my attention the whole time.
And keeps you on pins and needles, Rafer?
Yeah, I would agree. It's an incredibly gripping, really tense, and really intense movie. Great performances from everyone. Great directing from Denis Villeneuve, who did a movie called Incendies. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. He's a really good director. I think in some ways this movie is kind of a typical disappeared child, serial murder kind of film. But it's
very well executed.
It's so well made that you can overlook some of the cliches.
Absolutely.
Well, I know some of the history in this next movie. James Hunt and Niki Lauda were Formula One drivers who really, really had a rivalry back in the 1970s. Here's a clip from the movie Rush.
James, is there anything you'd like to add?
If Nicky is being tricky and getting a kicky out of playing mind games, then fine, I'm flattered. But the fact is, momentum is with me. I've never felt better. And I fully expect the next press conference we'll have will be with me as world champion.
So, how does this work, Rafer?
I think it works quite well off the track. I think you've got two great performances. That was Chris Hemsworth as James Hunt. Daniel Brühl, relatively new Spanish-German actor, plays Niki Lauda. Opposing personalities. Hunt is a playboy, charismatic, talented. Lauda is very disciplined, methodical, not a lot of fun. I think it's really interesting to watch these two personalities go for the same goal. The racing scenes, we were talking about Ron Howard's car movies, the racing scenes left me a little cold, but I think as a character study of these two, it works quite well.
I have to agree with Rafer about the racing scenes not holding my attention fully. They actually say very early on in the movie, there's a quote, "Women don't care about men driving around in circles 50 times," and I am one of the women who feels that way. I think the characterization... They could have delved deeper into the characters. The characters were interesting, but they should have been more interesting, and their conflicts should have been played up more. So it didn't turn out to be the best movie for me.
So this isn't like a Grand Theft Auto, Ron Howard's old Roger Corman movie with big NASCARs, right?
No? Slightly different.
And they don't go in circles in Formula One. They go in kind of little...
hairpin turns, yes.
All right, the final movie, we won't see a clip, but it's a documentary about the patients and workers at the last four late-term abortion clinics in the United States. Was this meaningful to you, Kristen?
You know, I thought this was fascinating. We don't normally look from the doctor's perspectives. We normally see from the news headlines the threats to their lives, but it was interesting seeing things from their perspective.
Yeah, I liked it. I would have liked a little more from the other side, but I do think it's an important film.
All right, Rafer Guzman, Kristen Meinzer, film critic for Newsday, culture producer for The Takeaway and the Movie Date podcast. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks, John.
Catholic Church is not the only religion concerned with enforcing strict rules for expressing piety and punishing those who find their own way by calling them apostates and enemies. For Catholics, it is struggles over women and their bodies and sexuality. For Muslims, there are some of those same struggles and the additional concept of jihad, roughly translated as holy war. Jihad is a term evoking terrorism and war in its clumsy references in the media, much more nuanced in a pious Muslim community.
The true jihad is to improve one's self spiritually. But your ignorant mullahs have reduced this noble concept to a joke. So they can go to paradise and claim their 72 virgins. or is it 82 these days? Where do they even get these figures? Certainly not in the Quran.
The Prophet has said it himself. The martyrs shall inherit the paradise.
An argument over the meaning of jihad forms the central drama in a new play called Noor, a play by Akbar Ahmed, Pakistan's former ambassador to the United Kingdom and chair of Islamic studies at American University. The newest iteration of his play, performed at American University, was directed by Manjula Kumar, a project director at the Smithsonian Institution, with a mission to bring the diversity of Muslim beliefs to light. In this production, the message is driven home by an Afghan cast, an Indian director, and a Pakistani playwright.
John, this is one form of expression of my mission almost in trying to create better understanding between peoples, between cultures, and to close this huge gap that opened after 9/11, particularly between Muslims and non-Muslims. And this play, of course, takes us straight into the heart of the matter, which is into an ordinary middle-class family, which could be set anywhere. It could be in Baghdad, in Karachi, in Cairo, in Kabul, and indeed not necessarily Muslim, because these dilemmas, these tensions, these conflicts are taking place in other societies also.
And we've described some of the plot of the play, Noor, in our introduction. But Manjula, what attracted you to this project? So many theater directors, the last thing they want to do is be involved in some preachy polemic.
Absolutely. Actually, I read this play. Dr. Ahmed had brought my attention to a few years ago, and I put it in the back burner. No, there's too much of talk of terrorism and Islam and all. No. But the day the Boston bombing happened, I just sat there frozen in front of the television. I was like a volcano for those days. And I decided one night, I have to do this. I have to do this not only for my own catharsis, but I have to understand, share with colleagues, with the public, what is it that made these two young boys who came to this country, the younger boy was 8 years old. So it became absolutely a need to do this, we have a lot of youngsters, you know, as cast members who started digging deeper into this whole issue of the three pillars of Islam. What exactly is the meaning of jihad? And, one of our characters says, we are struggling to create a modern society with law and order, justice and education for all. This is my jihad, the true jihad. Now, not many people even begin to think, what is the interpretation? What is the understanding?
You forget his most important saying on martyrdom is about scholarship. The ink of the scholar is more sacred than the blood of the martyr.
Ha, Ali, all this talk about education and learning is just a way to divert us Muslims from the real problems that we are facing today.
So this was the biggest challenge for me, the complex material itself.
You know, I'm unusual in the United States in that I learned about jihad in college shortly after the Iranian Revolution, where it was out there, but it was very much an obscure term. And in my college, the professors taught it as this personal struggle for understanding that jihad was something you were supposed to do, but it was all about your internal relationship with God and religion. It had nothing to do with certainly suicide bombings or anything of the kind. Does the prevailing news and the sort of post 9/11 era really ruin your ability to explain the broader dimensions of something like jihad, Akbar? And then I'd love to hear what you have to say.
John, that's a challenge, and I can't back out of the challenge in trying to correct what should be corrected. for Muslims especially, primarily, and then for non-Muslims. And of course, there's a quotation in the play which underlines the importance of scholarship, of balance of knowledge in Islam over martyrdom and blood. And I let Manjula quote it because it's a favorite quote of hers. It's a quotation of the Prophet of Islam.
Absolutely. And it says, "The ink of the scholar is more sacred than the blood of the martyr." Mm. And this is what is the crux, you know, of the play itself. And there are two brothers who have this different concept of jihad. One says, no, we need warriors, not mystics. And that's his jihad. And the other brother is saying, no, we need law and order. This is the tension that's going on, especially in the youth. But the play itself has the final message of peace. The Sufi message, which is also Dr. Akbar's life's work, is Sulekul, which is peace for all.
Audience reactions to people who've seen the production, performers' reactions at this early stage?
Well, John, let me tell you, it was first performed at Theatre J by my great friend Ari Roth, the artistic director there. And there was a group of soldiers there, including their colonel, the old guard from Washington. And the colonel, after the play in the Q&A, said, this is a play that President Obama should actually be seeing because this is a play that takes us right to the heart of the matter. For me, the most significant aspect of this particular play is that Manjula has been able to gather Afghans, Pakistanis, Indians, Americans to act in the play. So here we are in Washington performing something in unity with great harmony when back in South Asia, these countries are actually confronting each other and there's some tension between Afghanistan and Pakistan and India and Pakistan. India and Pakistan have even exchanged fire on the line of control. And here we have Indian background, Manjula, and Pakistani background, Akbar working in complete harmony.
Well, Manjula and Akbar, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank John. Thank you.
Akbar Ahmed is the chair of Islamic Studies at American University and Pakistan's former ambassador to the United Kingdom. He wrote the screenplay for Noor, and Manjula Kumar is the director of the play and a project director at the Smithsonian Institution.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity. Lumosity.com's daily workouts are designed to improve memory and attention, dedicated to helping people feel sharper, think faster, and remember more. It's all at Lumosity.com.
Often the sources for names are obvious. Greek mythology, names from the Bible, place names. For African Americans stripped of tribal and clan names during slavery, not entirely by choice, given names became prominent American white historical names. The Jeffersons, in many cases, the Jacksons, Washingtons, the Lincolns. At the end of the 20th century, the name Washington was believed to be 90% black, according to the U.S. Census. This conformity to a name with few authentic cultural roots encouraged families, particularly with first names, to embark on an adventure, to find new names, perhaps even made-up sounds that say something other than somebody named me Jefferson a long time ago. Markeith, Devante, Lakeish, Nakisha, Keon, Laquisha, names with their own origin and history. And with a history also available quite easily online, a history that sometimes makes the task of choosing a name that much more of a challenge. Nakisha Drayton has written of this challenge for our partner, The New York Times. Nakisha, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi.
So what were the options when you went about choosing or beginning the process of choosing the name for your unborn child?
Well, it was really early. We didn't know if it was a boy or a girl, and I really didn't have anything in mind yet. But the father of my child came with the idea that he wanted Keon as the name. And at first, it was a bit jarring to me because I knew somewhere in me that the name Keon sounded black. And from my personal experience with my name, I knew that I wasn't too sure if I wanted that to be my son's name.
So when you grew up, having the name Nakisha, even though it has its own historical and cultural roots, people right. just looked at that as just some black name.
Right, exactly.
What were the consequences for you? How did people treat you?
Well, luckily for me, it didn't personally affect me because of the fact that I always excelled at what I did and I didn't exactly grow up in the ghetto. But at the same time, you know somewhere in you that the name isn't acceptable. In fact, I have a comment that was posted on my article that kind of gives a little bit of what I was feeling, and it kind of hit it right in the nose. It comes from Kathleen in New York. She says, when I told my mostly black Girl Scouts that I was writing a book about the troop, I asked them for a fake name so none of them would be embarrassed by the story of their childhood. They all had names like Damara or Tanisha and Desiree, and they wanted their book names to be Emily, Jane, Sarah, and so on. And when I expressed this disappointment, they said in horror, what, you want us to have ghetto names?
And in your case, I mean, the way you describe it, even though you say the consequences were minimal for you, you have spent your life trying to exceed the expectations of your name by doing very, very well. It's like a race with the exactly. connotations of your own name.
Exactly. And even more so, I dropped half of my name and made it Nikki, so that on first appearance on a resume or anything like that, you would not see Nikisha as the first name.
All right. So your husband wanted the son to be named Keon. You were a little worried about this, so you did some investigating. And what did you discover?
Firstly, I looked at the meaning of the name. That's what really won me over to the name. And my heart just melted when I saw God is gracious and born of nobility and these strong meanings behind the name. But I remembered my first initial feeling of horror when I first heard it. And so I went into the image box in Google and typed in the name. And something came up, but that was still even more than I expected. Mugshots after mugshot after mugshot came up of black, young African-American men. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, oh my gosh, I can't even think of this name. And this is what's coming up. African-Americans and with mugshots, side profile, front profile, it didn't matter.
So now, did you scientifically try to see if virtually any name in the image box, if it's just a name search, brings up somebody who's been arrested somewhere?
Well, no, I didn't try to do any scientific proof behind it.
But you did discover some patterns.
But I did discover patterns, particularly, like I said, LaShonda, Devontae, anything that was sounding black or you know to be black, that was it. It came up mugshot after mugshot. And anything, Emily, Sarah, Kevin, anything that's, you know, to be a white name or a biblical name. In fact, it gave me little memorabilia about, say, it's Matthew. I love Matthew, came up with little coffee mugs. And yet, every time a black name went in, jumpsuits, mugshots. It was just so incredible.
So now you have a decision to make. What did you decide to do? Because, I mean, in a sense, those are individual people.
Right.
If you hadn't Googled that, you wouldn't necessarily have those connotations associated with the name.
Right.
But now you kind of can't escape it.
Well, I must say that I kind of caved Keon as the middle name, and I chose Marcus as the first name. I had to battle with myself a lot with it because I know from personal experience how it feels to have to always be battling against your name. So I didn't want my son to have to eventually be put in that position, just like I did and just like his father did. Because his father's name is Mark Keith, and he ends up using the name Mark for anything professional because he knows the connotation with having a black or the equivalent of a ghetto name.
So even though Mark or Keith individually are not ghetto names, Mark Keith is a ghetto name.
Well, yes, and Google does prove that as well. It does show all the mugshots of black men.
Well, we on our website have some of the same searches that you've done, so our listeners can actually see exactly what it is that you found.
Right.
I mean, this is a long battle, people battling their names. I mean, I suspect there were other kinds of battles going on in the 1800s for black families who were suddenly named Jefferson and Washington. It's a battle that continues even as you assume that your son is not going to end up in one of those image blocks, right? Or maybe he'll end up as a Nobel Prize winner, right?
Yeah, but growing up, you know what it is. And I'm not sure if it's something that I want for him to have to battle that against that every day, even within himself. You know, it's a battle that you have to battle every single day. You wake up and you know that, okay, I'm not going to use my full name. I'm going to have to shorten my name, or I'm going to have a nickname because I don't want to be seen as being ghetto.
Well, good luck. And is your son with us yet?
No, I'm still pregnant. 7 months.
And you're down with this decision, right? No turning back from here on.
No, that's the name. We fought hard with it.
Well, why don't we, when Marcus Keon is born,
you're right.
Let's get a picture up on our site to maybe blast out some of the alternative images there on Google.
Agreed.
All right, we'll do that for you.
All right, thank you.
All right, Nikisha Drayton, writer and expectant mother. Thanks so much.
Thank you, and thanks for having me.
My name is Brett. I'm calling from Parsippany, New Jersey. I was born in 86, the year after the Royals won the World Series, so I was named after the two of their stars, Brett Saberhagen and George Brett.
How'd you get your name?
My name is Crystalline. I'm calling from Saginaw, Texas. I got my name from my dad. He was a big country gospel fan, and I'm named after the Singer sisters, Crystal Gale and Loretta Lynn. Hence, Crystalline.
Thanks for that story, Crystalline. Here's something from Little Rock, Arkansas. My parents spent 7 years building a 30-foot-long double-ended Tahiti catch, which was launched in 1943, the year before I was born. When my mother first saw me, she said, "Here's the little skipper." And despite having been given a different surname, I've been Skipper or Skip ever since. Every name has a story. We'd love to hear yours. Give us yours at 877-8MYTAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. If you want to hear anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. And thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.